September 25th cabinet meeting in front of us, and I will start off by asking cabinet members to identify themselves who will be taking decisions at this meeting. Please show your hand. Thank you. There's no planned fire drills today, so if you do hear the continuous alarm, then you leave via the nearest exit and assemble outside the library, and the nearest exit, I believe, is there, or over there and out. The agenda and papers have been published on the Council's website in advance of this meeting in accordance with our Constitution. And just to remind everyone that access to information regulations does allow members of the public to film, record and report on public meetings, but they must not disrupt that meeting. And also, we may well have members of the press here. Not at the moment, I don't think. And we will be making an audio recording of the meeting so that we've got that record and publishing it on the Council's website in due course. Just to say that Cabinet members have declared interest and are listed for parish, town and City Councils behind me. Before we start, can I welcome Alison Nation, please? Alison, welcome to the meeting. Alison is from the CCG. And here for the GSNA item, so big welcome, thank you. Thank you for coming along, making the time. Apologies for absence, I've got Giuseppe Fascini, and I also think Sheila Collins as well is an apology. Mel Locke is also on holiday, welcome Mike. And
apologies from Jane Locke.
Okay. So I think that's everybody that we just need to log. But welcome, Mike, to your first meeting of the Cabinet, I think. I've already mentioned that members have declared their interest and that the list of personal interests and district, city, town, parish councils are available on the wall behind me. Everybody rushes to have a look. But we now move to item three, which is minutes of the meeting held on the 14th of August. My world, hasn't the world changed since the 14th of August? So I've got the minutes in front of me. And I'm looking at the first page, second, third, fourth, and fifth. Is there any comments, changes, or editing that you'd like to see? Everybody happy? Good. I will sign the minutes as a true record. Thank you. That moves us to public question time. And I note that there are no public questions that have been received ahead of the deadline, which was 5 p.m. last Thursday. So we move very quickly through public question time. It's not always like this, Alison. We don't move through the agenda this quick normally. Number five is the Joint Strategic Needs Assessment. And I'm going to hand over to Christine Lawrence to introduce, and then to Trudy Grant and Pip to give more details. And then we'll move on to discussion after that. So over to you, Christine.
Thank you. I'm delighted to bring this paper to you this morning. I think this is a topic that many of us have talked about over quite a few years, really, and I think it's a very important piece of work and not easy work. There may be some risks, but I know that we can balance those risks. I think it's more important as time goes by that we can do more for everybody in Somerset, working effectively together for the good of all of us. I'll draw your attention to 1.3 of the paper. I think data sharing will also enormously help to reduce inequalities throughout Somerset, have a positive impact on health and well-being, and fits in beautifully with the work that we're doing with improving lives. We had a very in-depth conversation at the Health and Wellbeing Board, and there was a unanimous decision to proceed with this piece of work. So I hope that you will have lots of questions, and we can reassure you that the direction of travel is the one that is the right way to go. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. Over to you, Trudy.
So, while Pip and Alison come on up, we usually do a joint strategic needs assessment.
Shall we just get them seated before you?
Yeah.
Do you want? Are they going to... Do you want to stand up, Pip, or...?
I'll stand up when I talk. Please.
OK. We'll just get you an extra chair there so that you're not both hovering.
So we usually do a joint strategic needs assessment either on a specific topic that we want to do a particular deep dive on or on an overall refresh of the information that we've got. The whole thing is held electronically in the Somerset Intelligence website, so it's available for everybody to interrogate and look at. But over the last 5 years or so, every single joint strategic needs assessment that we've done has highlighted that we can't go any further in understanding particular issues unless we've got better data integration across our system. So to that end, the Health and Wellbeing Board decided, as part of their statutory duties to produce a joint strategic needs assessment, that actually we do it on data integration to try and help move the system forward with regards to integrating data to improve the health and well-being and the lives of the population. So that's why it's a bit of a different joint strategic needs assessment. Alison's going to kill me, but it could be a little bit dry, but we're going to try and bring it to life just a little bit and give you a few examples of where actually data integration has already helped the system. We've got quite a long way to go, and other systems are further ahead to some extent, not totally, so we're kind of not doing badly, but there are some other areas that are further ahead with their data integration, so we really want to push it on now. So I'll hand over to Pip and Alison to talk a bit more.
Thank you. Do I need a microphone? Thank you very much. I think a lot of the introduction has already been covered, so I won't go through it. I'll get straight into the meat of it. And many of you will have seen this example of the recurrent problem. I use it a lot because it works very well. When we looked at vulnerable children about 3 years ago, we found there were about 6,000 reception-aged children. About a quarter of them were overweight, and about a quarter of them had decayed or missing teeth. And that's fine if that's all you're interested in, but what we're interested in knowing is, was it two groups, or was it a single group with both of those problems? And as Christine says, that is really about inequalities. Everything we know suggests it's probably closer to this end of the spectrum than the first one, but genuinely we can't answer it because we can't join the data up in the right way. Another example that we heard from the police, this I won't read it out, but it was a young man who was getting kind of yellow cards from a lot of agencies with which he had contact. But none of them kind of got to the red card, the red flag of we really need to address need of this young man, until he was arrested and the investigation went on. So by looking at the symptoms, the indicators, the conditions, the problems, the arrests, we weren't getting the whole person. Data integration is about working as a system. It's about person-centered care. Those two things are the same, two sides of the same coin, and without joining up the information, we can't do either of them. We could also look at different solutions. So here's an example. Someone has a hip fracture at the age of 80. New hip, that's what the NHS does, comes in, does a good job, replaces it. But maybe it's about reablement. Maybe we need to go back and look at the house they're living in, something that would stop the fall, make them live better. But maybe it's not about what you do in your 80s. Maybe it's about Pilates classes for people of my age so that we don't fall in the first place. That's a lot cheaper, and actually you get a lot better quality of life at the end of it. But why don't we do more of it? If it's so good, if it's so obvious, why not? And there are very good reasons. And at organisations, we look at those risks. You cannot go to a website without somebody flashing up a warning about, we look after your data, are you consenting to this? All the messages we get are about holding information in. And that's right. I'm not dismissing those in any sense. And that's where lots of organisations see the problem. But at the system level, we have that gross inefficiency of paying for a hip replacement when we could pay for a Pilates class. It's about treatment, not prevention. And at the very worst, we look at safeguarding, and Victoria Columbia is the perhaps the most famous example of failing to join up the understanding that we had of an individual. And whilst the risk may look big from an organisation level, it can be huge at a system level. So the decisions within organisations are taken by people like Caldecott Guardians, the conscience of health and care organisations, supported by information governance officers, protecting information. But where is the system view? Where do we take an assessment of the importance of sharing information for the whole person, for the whole system? And as a result of this analysis, the Health and Wellbeing Board, working with the Programme Executive Group, so PEG, which brings together the acute trusts as well, the Health and Wellbeing Board is setting up an Information Governance Approval Board, Information Governance Panel. It's very early stages. We haven't even agreed the name of it yet. But that will be to take a view at a system level. And I will come back to that, but I think that's really where we would like the support, not only from the board, but from Cabinet. It wouldn't be great if we talked about sharing information and working together if I just sat and did this by myself. So I'd like to hand over to my colleague from the NHS, Alison, who's already been introduced, who will talk about some of the excellent work that we are already doing in Somerset, and that is CIDR. So I'll hand over to Alison.
Thank you. Good morning, all. So just a few slides around the CIDR programme, aptly named maybe for Somerset, but it stands for the Somerset Integrated Digital Electronic Record. It's a programme of work around joining up the information so that when I as a patient with my parents or my family, anybody I might care for, that when I turn up at a service, I know they're going to have the information about that person they need to treat. And they know where the social care interaction is, where they are elsewhere, they're known in the system. So just a few slides around the CIDR programme. This includes NHS, County Council. We've also got the ambulance service and some early conversations underway with Fire and Rescue Service, care homes, the wider community voluntary sector. So we're trying to be inclusive, but we start with the core to start with. So what have we done so far? Over the last 3 years, four key initiatives that are currently live and underway. Live view, which is read-only access between adult social care records and our GP surgeries. And we've got 65 GP surgeries across Somerset. And again, with colleagues in Yeovil District Hospital, so just linked with the one acute at the moment. There is a video, but I'll share that at the end of the slide. EMIS viewer, so all of our 65 general practices use EMIS. They have enabled allowed access for reading the record information. So that's cradle to grave information about each of us that are registered in Somerset. And that information is available in other settings, A&E, 111 setting. It's available through the care professionals in County Council. And so far, that's been used 100,000 times. We're really starting to see the numbers on that ramp up each month now. As we get clinical and professional buy-in, they understand the value of looking at another point of call. That really helps us shape what's the clinical need, what's the professional need to support our patients, our local population. Learning disability assessments, you can see there since January 2017, over 1,600 hospital records have that awareness of an LD assessment. And end of life, working with St Margaret's Hospice and care homes and 111, starting to record those end of life records, those preferences that those individuals would like, are quite a key stage. And so far, over 700 records created, shared, with messaging between GPs and back to other care professionals. So I don't know if we can click on the web link there. It's got a link. This is just a little video from one of the GPs up at Froome Medical Practice, just to talk through, hopefully just give that clinical perspective of what it feels and looks like when they are meeting with patients. Is it going to work? No. Possibly not. The SIDA programme is going to continue, so there are at least another six areas of work that we're going to work on, again, across the whole system. So we'll see, as we're working around clinical and professional need, so they lead the development of that programme. It's what do they need at the point of care? And as I say, this is all around direct care rather than the population health aspects.
No. I assume this worked perfectly.
Yeah. Apologies.
That's right.
I'm not able to get any sound.
No.
We can
okay.
It after.
Yeah, yeah. It's there and available. It's a YouTube clip, so I think it just gives you the idea. Thank you. So I think that was only another slide. Thank you. So just to cover, Pip talked about the governance of this. So there is a current Somerset IG working group. All the governance leads are working together on that one to guide us, clinical and digital folks in the right direction. We've looked at a number of quick wins, as you've already seen. We're now starting to work on the actual shared care record. So that will provide a single view of information. It's view only at the point of care, rather than putting all that live data into one place. That needs different rules around consent and capture. So number of organisations involved. So a couple of screenshots, which apologies are not going to come out. You can see across the top line there are a number of tabs with coloured bars against them. Those represent each of the organisations within our system. So whichever organisation you are in, this link through for part of the County Council Service, their AIS system, they will have a tab within theirs. They'll be able to go through to this screen and see what information is available from the GP, from the Community Mental Health Trust, or from the Acute Trust. And that's all being worked up, led by clinicians. What's the information they need to see from those records at the point of care? So not necessarily dry. I think this is quite exciting. This is really taking this forward now. Sorry, Julie. So that's just a brief overview, but hopefully that gives you some idea of what we're working on.
Thank you, Alison. Pip, are you...
Thank you. Just to sum up and come back to the point about why this is coming to Cabinet, quite clearly... It's about partnership, but each organisation has to take ownership and leadership in this approach, and it's important that the Cabinet is completely on board for that.
Right. Trudy, any concluding words, or before I get into questions?
No, we're open to questions.
Okay. So I've got two immediate ones, Alison. The first one is probably easier than the second one. So the first one is we took a... took a presentation the other day in what we have as closed cabinet from SAFA, which is the just remind me somebody, David, right, anybody? Yeah, and they're dealing with ex-veterans, ex-servicemen out there, and their big issue was sharing information and how they can access information and the information they have and how they can feed that into the system. So I'd like to think that voluntary organisations like SAFA are being included.
So yes, absolutely, that's about us becoming aware of those organisations, where the key need is. As soon as we know who they are, we're very happy to have that first conversation. How do we bring them into the fold of conversations?
Okay, I think we can put you in contact, because this was exactly what they were saying, I think, Christine.
Perfect.
That they need to be able to give information as well as perhaps receive information.
Yep. Yep.
That was the first one. The second one is probably a much bigger one. Why are we doing this locally and not nationally?
Good question. So a few years ago, there was a national programme for IT, And I think because of the enormity of it and local variation of current status of digital IT systems, I don't think that worked in every area. Certainly, we are still part of a regional conversation, local healthcare record work that's going on, so that's where I'm headed next, actually. But there was a view in Somerset, certainly from Digital Leeds, that we needed to make sure we could join up the dots, if you like, for our local organisations. And, you know, that's seen some challenge around engagement. The governance piece needs to be sorted out. And we're a fairly simple system. I say that, you know, sort of five groups of core organisations, County Council, CCG with general practices, and three NHS trusts. So the idea is if we can get those to join up, share the information, get comfortable, assurance, trust builds, then you can start to be part of a wider system. So we're part of that regional conversation.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Right, around the table, any questions? Mandy, then John.
Thank you. I have a couple, really. The first is around digitalisation of records. I know the NHS were looking to get all their patient records. There was a lot of, I think, government funding to actually do that. So my first question is, has that happened?
So yes, that is underway. So we have a Somerset Digital Delivery Board, which we are starting to formulate what that programme looks like to feed up to the system level so that we've got an awareness of what's going on across the patch. As already pointed out, we've got 65 general practices. They are already digitised, have been for, you know, sort of 20, 30 years now. What we're doing is working with the trusts, working with the council to make sure their systems, we're moving away from paper where it still remains, moving to fully electronic systems. That's going to take some time. Taunton and Somerset Hospital, I've got a Global Digital Exemplar programme. That's got some significant funding. And we've had some other funding through health system-led investment, which Pat will be aware of, and primary care equally, some estates and technology transformation funding. So we're attracting because we're doing, because we've got the governance in place, and now it's about getting that resource in place, clinical, patient buy-in, local population aware of what we're doing. Because as Christine said, it's that risk of not sharing really is where we're at the moment. So
it's fair to say we're not quite there yet, and it's probably the same as the council. I know we have certain paper records. So that's a competency. Unless we can get to putting everything on a digital record, we can't share in the first place. My second question is, and whilst I absolutely agree with sharing data, a lot of, actually, especially young people, are really uncomfortable with everybody having access to their data. And whilst the young man you talked about there briefly had all those yellow cards, that young man actually might not be very happy that everybody's sharing his information. So for me, it's how you get around that and the public don't actually feel that you are just taking over without them being aware.
Absolutely agree. I've got a couple of teenagers myself, so it's how do they see their information. So we are starting to, I've got a couple in my team, are digital comms and engagement supports, and they are linking with local colleges, sixth form, going to Freshers' Fairs. I'm doing an assembly next week with a primary school. How do we engage with the parent carer forum? We're really trying to reach out through all the communication engagement routes we've got available so that we are informing people. We've had a two-page spread in the Your Somerset every time that goes out now. That's something we've done for about a year. So we're trying really hard. Always welcome for new ideas on how we might engage with local people.
Thank you. I'm going to hold it there, move on. Yeah, if that's all right. John.
Thank you, Chairman. I sort of first came across this about 10 years ago with data sharing with Cross Blue Light Services. And it always seems to me that we, although very important, don't get me wrong, I'm not, we talk about the governance and the problems and the things. And I think when we talk about data sharing and data analysis, we should also talk about the fantastic outcomes that can be gleaned from this. I mean, the more accurate information you've got about people, because they're all the same people, those people at risk of crime, at risk of arson, or risk of health problems, are the same people that are vulnerable. And the more you can direct your resources, and the better the outcomes, you can get far more efficiency by doing this. And I don't think we talk about this in an exciting enough way, because data, although I know you always said it to start with, it's a really dry subject, but actually the outcomes can be absolutely brilliant.
I don't think that was a question. I think that was a very passionate statement, but doesn't need an answer. Faye.
A lot of what I was going to say has been covered. I think everybody knows that I'm a passionate advocate for any kind of data sharing that can deliver results. One of the things that is mentioned in the paper in section 1.5 is an effort should not be wasted on data integration that does not produce such benefits. I'd be interested to find out how you're going to figure that out, because I think if you can figure that out, you could sell that for the price of gold. So good luck, but I'd like to hear a bit more around that. And I think the other thing is clearly around communication and actually people understanding how this can work positively for them and being assured in the resilience of both the data collection and privacy processes. And I think there will be a really big challenge around how we do bring our third-party sector into this data sharing, because actually, if you're a nurse, a doctor, a social worker, everybody recognises that professionalism. Our third sector volunteers absolutely have that, but if we don't have resilient processes to make sure that they're being held to account in the same way and that the public can have that reassurance, I think there will be a struggle in how you get the buy-in. So I'd be interested to know how you're going to approach that and how, as well as getting across, you know, this is the positive stuff that we can do with data sharing, that reassurance side saying, and if something goes wrong, this is how we will react, this is how quickly we will do it, and this is what we will reassure you with, in the same way that a private company who holds data needs to do. So just a bit more around how you're going to figure it out.
There was three questions in there.
So I'm going to try and remember all, so I might need prompting. So the communication, I'll take that first, absolutely. Since I've led the CCG digital team, we've been much more about IT in the back office, shiny objects, and more about that communication and engagement. That is absolutely key. We can't do it without. So we have got a couple of groups we've set up in the last year. One is a clinical liaison oversight group. They kind of indicate to us what's the direction of travel. How do we, let's weed out the stuff we don't really need and what's the essential stuff. So that's the bits we need to focus on first, hence the first four pieces of go live. And then it's around that wider comms and engagement work. So we're working with our communication leads through yours at the council as well. How do you get that message out and across? And by doing that, then you start to build the benefits, those use cases of where it has worked, where it has made a difference. And that's where you start to get that trust and reassurance. Mm-hmm. And that's how we've worked with our 65 general practices is, you know, we want to do this. So they've shared part of their record to start with, not the coded information, just the coded information, sorry, not the extra text. Then they could see that reassurance was happening, that there was an audit trail in place. You provide that back and they said, yeah, okay, we'll open it up to the next group of professional staff and we'll actually open up the free text. And that's made such a difference to those people, those professionals that are on the ground. So that's two bits, I think, covered. The bit about third sector, community and voluntary organisations, so I'm really keen on that. So we're working with care homes at the moment. Pip's just mentioned the housing associations, starting to work through district councils. What are those other agencies that we need to work with in health? It's not about three NHS trusts and 65 practices. We know there's a huge range of socially based services that are out there. We need to work with them. How do we support them getting on board with information sharing? That's part of this next year's work. Who are they? Let's start that conversation.
Very quickly.
It's just really to encourage you. You're talking about the voluntary service and how you're dripping through stuff with professionals. I think start those conversations early with the voluntary service. Get something out through all of the charities. I mean, we've spoken to them and ask them how they think it can work, because there's nothing worse than being delivered a fait accompli.
Francis, please.
It goes with the always checking back that the data that you're sharing is the data that's useful to the people who are going to use it, which means a very strong user group, which is not the patient or the customer or the citizen group, but the user group, which I hope I'll be reassured on.
Absolutely.
That's yep. Great. That's one. The second one... they're two rolled into one, really. There is a website, Somerset Choices. There is another website, West Somerset Community Directory, which is, I understand, paid for by the CCG. I've just looked up the same thing on both of them. So there's a great chunk here about data sharing information going outwards to the citizen rather than inwards. I mean, this is you know, I don't care which one it is, but they ought to be one, not two. And the going with that, the tying into the community sector, because of course for those there is a lot of knowledge in people who run those directories as to where the community sector.
I'm going to have to hurry you up.
Right, so the voluntary sector is, and there are umbrella organisations, which I hope you are talking to, because this is really important.
So, yes, some of that. West Somerset Community One was community-led. That's how it started, the same as the Froome Mendip Connectors model. We know we've got some work in that website space to start and make it a single point of access. So that is definitely on the cards, but that's about knowing all of that local work to start with. If there are other agencies we need to work with, I just need to know who they are to start that conversation.
Okay, thank you, Alison. I think that's the questions cabinet. I'm just going to, you haven't got away yet, don't worry, there's more to go. I'm going to go around the table. Other elected members? Liz Leishen, please.
Thank you, Chair. I've seen EMIS work brilliantly at an out-of-hours GP in Yeovil Hospital, and it made such a difference. The GP on duty was absolutely amazed that it worked, and he said, please don't think this will happen every time, but it made all the difference. And my concern, Chair, and the question I want to ask is what happens to a Somerset resident who goes to a Bristol or a Bath hospital?
To hear the feedback. I'll share that. The regional piece that I'm going to next, that's about how do we share that information across the region. So we've already got conversations with the ambulance service, which is a regional service. The next kind of donut effect, as we call it, is who are the next round of trusts. So it'd be Dorchester, Exeter, Western, Bristol, Bath, RUH. How do we engage with them? And they've all got digital programmes ongoing as well. How do we engage with them? I go shopping in Bristol. I'd like to know I was covered with my health information being available. So I'm no different to any other resident of Somerset. So, yeah, under the plan.
If I may just point out, I do feel happier listening to this knowing that the GDPR regulations are in place now. If we'd heard it 2 years ago, we might not have been so keen.
Thank you, Liz. Any other questions? Tessa Munt, please.
Thank you. Really interesting presentation. Just very quickly, I can see how you've dealt with the professionals and the trusts. I can see how you're looking at dealing with volunteers. There's a bit in the middle, which is those who are contracted to provide care in nursing homes and care homes and all the rest of it. Did I miss that bit? I may have done.
So care homes, residential, those care services, absolutely. So we've got some live work at the moment, started about 4 weeks ago, to look at what's called the Data Security and Protection Toolkit. Can we give those providers an NHS mail account? So do the email in, linking in. So we're trying to provide them mechanisms with some simple support in place. Because we know the information governance can be complex, it can be a bit daunting. So how do we support those providers to come on board and be part of it? Because usually they're already receiving patient information already. So let's just get them on board. Let's give them that support. So, yeah, that's part of the programme.
Yes, I was going to say, sometimes that's where the system goes wrong, where GPs are doing one thing, the medicines aren't arriving in the care home, or they're not being used correctly, or they're not being distributed properly. So there's a problem area there that might be sorted out. Thank you very much indeed.
Great. Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions? No. So we come to the end. I think we've all found it fascinating. I know Trudy said it was going to be dry, and I thought the first time we looked at it, it was going to be dry, but I think you've brought it to life, and I think there's some really valuable work going in here. This is pretty fundamental, so yeah,
thank
all
you.
Power
it's,
to you.
It's great to hear the feedback, so yeah, keep me driving forward.
So we come to the recommendations that are in front of us for Cabinet to approve that Somerset Our County Joint Strategic Needs Assessment 2019 data integration and the responsibility for managing and balancing the risks associated with data integration taken on by the Health and Wellbeing Board in setting up the Information Governance Panel. All those in agreement with those recommendations, please show. That is unanimous. Thank you, Alison, for your time, and good luck with the next meeting. Go and sort Bristol and Bath now.
Thank you very much.
Dorchester and the rest of them. Thanks, Pip, as well. This leads us on to item six, which is quarter one plus one performance report, and it's for me to introduce this item, to say a few words, and then hand over to Simon. I don't know if we want to change the screen before we... So I think the performance report shows a strong performance across the board for the quarter that ended in July, and I'd ask Cabinet members and those in the room to very much bear that in mind. I think it's easy to fall and spot the negatives, where actually there's a lot of very good work going on here. And my thanks especially to all the officers and to members for their contribution. We will hear later this morning a full breakdown of the Council's up-to-date finances, and that good news stories continues to underpin the successes that are outlined throughout this report, but I'm certainly not going to steal Mandy's thunder on it. From delivering on our major capital projects such as Colley Lane improvements in Bridgewater through to enterprise and innovation centres, we are seeing an investment in our economy and transport that will support jobs and boost spending power from our residents. This is great news. Looking at our major people services, adults and children's, again, the report highlights improved performance that I'm sure we'll all welcome. Page 19 in particular highlights significant changes in the way we work with partners to safeguard children. And page 26 details successes in our adult services, with more people using personal budgets or receiving direct payments, a measure that has improved for 8 months now. An area of my own Cabinet responsibility is the continuing success of our contact centre. I know many of you claim that, but it does fall under this Cabinet member. And page 31 details that the number of customers having their social care call resolved there and then is at an all-time high level. My congratulations to the team, which of course is an award-winning contact centre. There are a number of areas where we clearly do need to do more and to improve. Those are highlighted throughout the report itself, and I hope that that's very clear to members and to other to members of the public. It's sometimes easy to lose sight of some of the fantastic work that takes place every day in our authority. We can get sidetracked very easily for a number of reasons, so this corporate performance report brings us back to the message. I'm sure all council members would want to acknowledge that our staff do a great job day in, day out, helping and supporting residents and our communities, and I'm very grateful to all that are involved. With nothing more to say, I'll hand over to Simon, who will introduce the report in more detail.
Thank you, Chair. So this is the latest iteration of the report. The cover report will point out that there are 38 performance indicators, 22 of which are continued from previous ones and 16 of which are new indicators. These new indicators are outlined in a summary of the cover report. They include the three-year MTFP, climate change strategy. Ironically for me, with those of you who know that I've been laid low with flu, there is a flu action plan that's in there, and a new measure for digital opportunities for residents accessing the authority. The leaders highlighted some of those performance areas, particularly in children's services, and I'd emphasise that too. This report has a significant number of metrics from Julian's area, Julian Francis's area, such as working with partners to ensure effective early help, improved children safeguarding with partners, improving outcomes for children looked after, improving outcomes for emotional health and wellbeing of children, and for vulnerable learners. There's a whole suite that we're bringing forward. These, just to reinforce, these are all measures that are currently being held and have done for a number of years in many cases. What we're doing is bring them into this particular report so they're easier to see and access. The cover report highlights areas of success in 2.2.1 through to 2.2.9. I quite like saying that, I'll say it again. 2.2.1 to 2.2.9. And for balance, it also highlights areas of concern in 2.3.1 and 2.3.2. Cabinet will note that one or two of the performance tables in the main report will be populated later this year in quarter two as data becomes available. That's because some of them are brand new metrics, so there's, for instance, the digital customer one. The high-level summary on page 29 of the actual report shows red, amber, green rating, 18 green, 15 amber, just the single red. The same page also shows the direction of travel at a glance. And the last bit of housekeeping from me. This report should be read alongside existing documents such as the financial and risk reports to gain a full understanding of the Council as a whole. A reminder that not all measures have an arrow giving a direction of performance indication. So as a, for instance, as a measure there about the Housing Infrastructure Fund, that's clearly waiting on a government decision later this year, so there's no direction of travel appropriate for that. And that will explain why some of the overall figures don't seem to match up. James is sitting in the corner over there, James Hadley. He's the one responsible for bringing this forward, together. I think this is a really good report, but any technical questions I'm going to deflect straight onto him. Yeah. SLT directors are, of course, here to answer questions about their own area. And finally, the tables and the narrative are constantly being tweaked. I've sat here a number of times now and taken comments from Cabinet members and from other members and actually from other people around the organisation, and we constantly tweak and reiterate this performance table and the information within it, and that will continue. So if people want to see things brought forward or dropped out and other things brought forward, do make that view known, and we will do what we can. We're trying to make this as clear and as helpful and as transparent as possible, but obviously these are 38 measures of a suite of hundreds and hundreds through the organisation. And with no ado, Chair, that's back to you.
Thank you. James, I think we've probably stolen all your thunder, have we? Is there anything else you'd like to add before I open it up for questions?
No, that's everything. Thank you.
Okay. Right. Questions, please, from Cabinet members. David Huxtable.
Well, thank you, Chairman. It's funny enough, it's on the flu issue. I just wonder if Trudy could add some encouragement to some people sitting around this table who seem to find that the idea of flu immunisation is something that they don't want to get involved in. Thank you, Chairman.
I think Simon might be in a better position having just had flu, actually. So flu is a really nasty disease, and I think unless you've had it, you probably don't realise what it's really like, and most of you will have had colds and not flu. It is...
Really? I get flu every year.
Men have flu, yes, all right.
We get special man flu, don't we?
It does cause, the flu season does cause significant demand in our health and social care services. This year, I'll just go into the vaccination programme a little bit. So the vaccination programme, we traditionally get quite good figures on the uptake in the over 65 population. We're still not quite meeting the 75% mark, which is what we will need to try and achieve, but we're not far off. We're doing really well on the childhood vaccination programme for flu, which is brilliant. The bit that we're not doing very well on at the moment in Somerset is the at-risk groups in under 65. So this is people with pre-existing conditions recognised by the National Vaccination Programme as being at more significant risk of flu and the consequences of flu. So we are this year going to try and do far more of a system-wide approach to the flu vaccination programme. So we've been and presented to the chief execs across the health system as well, and we're going to have a real focus on seeing what we can do to improve the levels of vaccination of that 65 at-risk group, under 65 at-risk group in particular. Within that, we particularly, there's a number of groups within that, but we particularly want to make sure that we get vaccinated people with liver disease, because the mortality from flu, if you've got liver disease, is far higher than some of the other conditions. So that's one that we really want to push forward. As part of the whole vaccination programme, absolutely, if you're in an at-risk group, if you're eligible for the flu vaccination, I would urge everybody to get it. Even if you're not eligible for it on the NHS or locally, then actually you can still buy it from Tesco's or wherever you choose to go. We are also going to be focusing on our own staff and the NHS staff that are eligible for flu vaccination. So the reason being that actually not necessarily so as it protects them from flu, although it will, but actually so as it also protects the vulnerable people that they work with from flu. So we, at the moment, are looking at doing a programme for Somerset County Council staff whereby the staff can go and have their flu vaccination and can reclaim that back to the from the council through the expenses claim forms. So we'll put the information out soon to staff as to who is eligible to do that in the staff group.
Thank you. Other questions, please, on any aspect? Mandy.
Thank you. I think we're talking about bringing documents alive, and I think this is the one document that the council produces that has that link between the vision, the plan, and what we're looking to output. So I find it a really useful document. I think compared to looking at this in previous years and times in the council, I think there is so much information that is now crammed into it, and I really welcome that, absolutely. Just to say about the contact centre, anybody that hasn't paid them a visit, I did, and I have to say...
It's got to be a question, Mandy.
They're inspiring. My question is around page 42. Our young people, let me find my bookmark, excuse me. And it was around our... improve the outcomes for children looked after. So this for me is an absolute key area, as we're all corporate parents. So I suppose for me it's the reassurance of the interventions that are going on and how we learn more. I do sit on the corporate parenting, but it's just that reassurance that work's going on, because if we don't improve the outcomes for our children, we are ultimately all responsible for them. So it's just that reassurance for me, please.
Yeah, so obviously there's a whole programme of work which gets reported to the Corporate Parenting Board in terms of outcomes to improve children looked after, and as the report indicates, there's a number of activities in this quarter which is particularly focused on improving the health outcomes for children looked after. It's important to say we've made great progress with the NHS, but that's from a very low base. So we have got improvements. It's fair to say some of the most vulnerable children are now getting the services which they should have probably got earlier. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Julian. Before we go any further, I just want to bring in David, because I know that having looked through this before, I think one of the really exciting areas is the innovation centres, and I think it's worthwhile just focusing on that just for a few minutes. And I think you or Paula have put a few slides together. So over to you, and then we'll carry on with the questioning.
Thanks, David, and thank you to everybody for this opportunity. Just to give this short update on the programme, the Innovation and Enterprise Centres programme, I think this is a really good news story, something that as an authority we should be proud of it. I think we also all recognise that in these confusing political times, there is a direction of travel which we all recognise, which is that a healthy and thriving economy is important to all of us in enabling us to provide the services for our electorate, for our population that they need in these challenging times. So, as I say, a very good news story, and delighted to be able to just give you a quick update, which Paula and I will do as a double act.
Do you want me to cover this one?
If you like.
Diagram there on the right-hand side is really trying to show how our work in our Enterprise and Innovation Centre network links in with the government's industrial strategy and our own local industrial strategy, and particularly linking in with those two themes of clean growth and inclusive growth. And what we're doing through our enterprise centres is an intervention programme where the market is not providing. This isn't about competing with the private sector, it's about providing where the market isn't. And that's particularly for enterprise centres around start-up space, getting businesses off the ground and offering them that business support they need to be successful and to thrive and grow, and probably most likely leave us and move on to premises elsewhere as they grow. Innovation centres, slightly different focus. They're about providing collaboration space, particularly supporting some of our recognised industrial strengths, business strengths, and supporting the supply chain for those. And boosting that enterprise and innovation, providing for us income stream business rates, and as those businesses are successful, it's important for us, and investment opportunities. And And addressing, as I said before, that market failure in terms of the private sector providing space for start-ups, and that's particularly in our more rural areas that we see that as an issue. So what have we got currently? We currently have 5 enterprise centres. You'll see where they are there. We have a company who manages those for us, TDA, and they're really successful. We're on over 95% occupancy rate, currently about 97%. You know, a number of people employed there. So you look at those numbers, 139 jobs in our rural areas are really quite important in supporting our economy. And in terms of innovation centres, most people have seen that building as you come down the A38 into Bridgewater, the Somerset Energy Innovation Centre. Phase one is pretty much running at 100% occupancy, been really successful. And we've got 68 businesses receiving in-depth support there. It's really supporting at the moment the supply chain for Hinkley, but actually also that larger opportunity around the low-carbon economy. Phase two build, recently completed, will allow that expansion space for those businesses who want to come in but can't. Currently, there's no space for them, and phase three is underway. And it's probably worth saying all these builds are generally supported by money we draw down through the local enterprise partnership, through some of the ERDF funding programmes. They're not primarily funded by the County Council, they're funded by others largely. Underway, we have iAero in Yeovil supporting our aerospace industry and their supply chain. And that last month, yes.
Only last month. Last month
we did the, so the work really getting underway on site there will be completed summer 2020. A really exciting collaboration with Leonardo Helicopters and their supply chain, and then also bringing forward Wells and Wetherlescombe Enterprise Centres. Again, just getting those schemes out the ground. So some really exciting developments in the pipeline.
I'm particularly proud, if I can just add to that, that we've actually got to the start of the build on iAero. It's been quite a long time coming. It's often said that in the Somerset economy, we tend to focus a little bit too much on the west of the county with all that's going on around Hinkley Point. But we should never forget how important aerospace is to the county. And I'm absolutely delighted, as Paula says, that we've got such good support from Leonardo. Also, in conjunction with what's going on at iAero, I think I'm able to say now that the announcement is public that we've got a senior director from Leonardo likely to be joining the local enterprise partnership to support the work we do. So a really good buy-in, anchoring not just Leonardo, but the supply chain, which has an overlap into so many other areas of technology that we're engaged in Somerset, is hugely important. So I think the iAero Centre in particular, I don't like to just focus on one, but that is a very significant step forward for the Somerset economy. Sorry, Paul.
Look, absolutely fine. And then just a final slide there about some of our ambitions going forward. A digital innovation centre for Taunton, a marine geospatial hub, which would tie in with the UK Hydrographic Office being in Taunton. The things we're bidding for, I can't say hand in heart that every single one of these will come to fruition, but the ambition's there, and we will, you know, continue to plug those ones and try and make sure that we're successful. Bruton Enterprise Centre, and then potentially in the future, looking at how we're using surplus STC space at Willerton and Wellington to support enterprise and innovation again. So I think, and I haven't mentioned Chard there as well, which is another one that we're progressing. So I think a lot of activity here, a lot of support across the whole of the county, and something that, you know, I think as a county, we are really making a difference to our businesses by supporting them. So thank you.
Good, thank you. So any questions, Faye? This is on innovation, enterprise centres, or any other part of this report?
On the innovation centres in particular, I'd like to reiterate the delight that we have in South Somerset of Aero. There's always lots of speculation about Leonardo, and I think it's really great to see their roots getting even deeper into the community and actually bringing on the next generation of what's going to happen in that industry. It's really exciting. We've got Yeovil College doing great things with them as well. So I can't wait to see the building up and running, and it can't come soon enough. You've talked about a lot of successes and the high occupancy rates across the county on this. And obviously the idea of these innovation centres is that people are moving on. So just interested to see what the plans are and how we're going to monitor moving forward. If we're at 97% or 100% occupancy rate, how are we supporting those businesses to take the next step? And what are we doing with those on the waiting list to try and help them in the meantime? Are we directing them to other parts of the county, or are we supporting them in other ways? And just overall, fantastic news. I think it's what Somerset needs.
Thank you, Faye. Yeah, it's a complex matrix, and it does need monitoring. I know John will endorse what I say, that we've had an incredible throughput of businesses in the Highbridge Enterprise Centre, and some amazing businesses that have got a foothold in the economy and have moved on and have expanded and made space for others. But it's something that we constantly monitor. We also work with the businesses in the innovation centres, in the enterprise centres, to understand what their next move might be. What I'm particularly conscious of, I think we're all conscious of, is that we are in the middle of the Hinkley Point build, but it won't last forever. Our big task now, apart from managing the impacts of day-to-day activity, is to make sure we secure the legacy of that build and encourage the new businesses, the clean energy builds, clean energy businesses, to stay in Somerset and expand and grow. I'm particularly delighted that the Enterprise Centre on the way into Bridgewater that features in the pictures here is so close to the Enterprise Zone, now taken over by Salamanca as the main developer, and there will be an ongoing tie-in. So the long-winded answer to your short question is that we work the matrix, we communicate with all the businesses as much as we possibly can, and try to help them in their throughput and help them to grow and develop and make the space for the next generation. It's a complicated task.
Thank you. Pat wanted to say a couple of words.
I was just going to endorse what David said, having had experience of the Enterprise Centre in my patch. It absolutely works. What's important is that turnover, because what can happen is people can take those because it's a fantastic place to be and then want to stay there. You've got to make sure that they're ready to go to the next step and you get that churn, so you get the input and the output.
Thank you. I'm going to take us away from innovation centres now. I want to go to health visitor mandated contacts, which is page 20 of the report. I'm just looking at the trend now. I presume, Trudy, you're going to be able to answer this for me. But there does seem to be a downward trend over the last three or four quarters, and we've now fallen into amber. Can you just reassure me there is a plan to bring that back?
There's only a downward trend for the last two quarters. Am I looking at the same one? Health visitor mandated contacts?
Yeah, so it's gone down 94 to 89.5 to 85.1.
Yeah. So there is a plan to bring that back, absolutely. There are two things, I think, which influence this. The first one is, obviously, we've had the transfer of health visitors from the NHS into the local authority. As part of that transfer, we knew that we would lose some health visitors during that transfer. So in quarter four, we had lost some of the health visitors by then. They then transferred over, came into this organisation from April. And obviously we've carried some vacancies since then. We're now in a process of reappointing those posts, so we'll be back up to full staff complement. So there's that issue which has impacted it. But also we've had a bit of an issue with the notification of new babies from midwifery service into their health visiting service, which we've now sorted. So hopefully that one should be back up as soon as we can get it back up.
Okay, thank you very much. Any Faye?
Just really around the delayed transfers of care attributable to adult social care, I can't say that, sorry. I attended the AGM of Yeovil District Hospital the other night and saw a really good joint presentation between the county and the hospital on how we're managing this. And it's one of those success stories that we've seen over the last year. but it's creeping back up. Is that a trend or is it a summer blip? How are we going to stop it from being a summer blip next year? Because there does seem to be that peak during the summer months. And is the trend going to come back down again?
It's a bit like the crisis in there's always a winter crisis in the health service in the winter. And because a lot of our care staff are on 0 hours contract, there is always a lack of them during the school holidays. Some of them find it, well, some of them work on 0 hours contract because they choose to, and others choose work on it because they have to. But certainly in the summer holidays, some of them find it's they want to spend more time with their children, so they are unavailable. And some of them choose to they not put their child into care because it's into child care because it's cheaper. This is largely a problem around the community hospitals because we have a lot of them. And we work very closely with acute, as you well know. But I think we're looking at a service as at the system of availability of these care packages, because obviously we can't send people home unless it's safe enough to do so. And to do that, we need the carers. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from around the table on this report? Nope. Got to go around the room. Legislation, please.
Thank you, Chair. I know you said enough on innovation and enterprise centres, but I just wondered about their location and whether, when deciding a location, whether broadband services are taken into account at the first stage and whether any of those potential hubs are in areas where the phase two of CDS might be a factor.
In terms of deciding locations, we're really looking at where the market is failing to provide space for that start-up business and where there is a shortfall. So that is the determining factor, is for the enterprise centres market failure. The innovation centres are more around our major strengths of businesses and supporting their supply chains. We aim always within our enterprise centres to provide really good connectivity. So that's one of our aims. But, as I say, it's more about where the markets fail to provide than about what the services in that area are. Often, the predominantly in rural areas, which are the same areas that are likely to suffer historically from poorer broadband services.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? No, thank you very much indeed. So just to look at the recommendations that are before us, we've been asked to consider and comment on the information contained within this report. Where performance issues are highlighted, Cabinet have considered whether the proposed management actions already in a place are adequate to improve performance at the desired level, and if the Cabinet are of the view that the actions are not adequate, then we've indicated what further actions should be required to ensure performance is improved. And subject to any amendments agreed under the above points, to agree this report and any appendices is the latest position of Somerset County Council against its council vision. All those in agreement of those recommendations, please show.
That's unanimous, Chair.
Unanimous. Thank you all. That moves us on to month four, quarter one plus one revenue report. Budget, we haven't got Sheila today, but we have got Lizzie, who I'm sure is just as capable to take us through the figures. But over to Mandy to introduce.
Thank you. I'll just start, and then Lizzie will just pick up some technical points after, if we may. So this is the third revenue budget monitoring report to Cabinet in this financial year, and I'm pleased to again present a forecast balanced budget position by the end of the year. This position gives further assurance, and we're now a third of the way through the year, and clearly demonstrates the continued tight grip that the Council has on its finances. There are, however, still 8 months of the year to go, and as is always the case, forecasts can alter, and risks always remain in some service areas, especially where demand for services are driven by our demographics and are to some extent seasonal. Every effort during the year is made to manage these demands and will continue.
The forecast balance position assumes that small service variance is offset by a notional allocation of the corporate contingency. Nevertheless, the contingency balance is still £6 million. This is currently unallocated, and if it remains uncalled upon for variations as the year progresses, this will be funding available to further improve the Council's longer-term financial resilience. Although this report is less detailed than last month's fuller quarterly report, it does still update on reserves, capital receipts, flexibilities, and progress on the delivery of savings. These savings remain of critical importance, and it can be seen in Appendix B that focus on delivery remains strong, with over 99% of savings forecast to be delivered by the end of the year. This report contains one recommendation for approval, and that's the transfer of £175,000 from corporate contingency. This is the allocated grant funding for Brexit that was previously assumed to be additional funding for existing activity. However, it's now very clear that central government's expectation is that these sums will be used to enhance capacity within the council. Members will also be aware that central government announced a spending round on the 4th of September. This covers just 1 year, 2020 to 21. The announcement appears to be a positive one for this council and therefore the residents of Somerset. It confirms that much of the uncertain funding will continue just for the 1 year, and that additional funding, mainly for social care and high needs education, is to be allocated in that year. Whilst we welcome this additional funding, the uncertainty remains beyond that. It is therefore imperative that these announcements do not detract from the work that we have underway to continue to strengthen the financial resilience of the Council, and we must continue to manage pressures such as demand within our services. In conclusion, this third revenue budget monitoring report for 1920 demonstrates the continued improving financial position for the Council, and I'm sure Cabinet welcomes this. Members will be happy to answer any specific questions on their service variations. And if I can hand over to Lizzie.
Lizzie, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I've just got a couple of additional points to make associated with funding and revenue impacts. So the close monthly tracking and change control mechanisms that existed in 2018-19 to ensure that savings are tracked and delivered remains in place throughout this financial year. It is showing now with that significant increase in savings delivery forecast, and we're really pleased to see that continuing. We're expecting government to be publishing technical consultations in relation to the mechanisms for the distribution of the additional funding that was announced in the spending review that Councillor Chilcott has just referred to. We are hoping that, obviously, it's a positive position for Somerset. We will be reviewing them in detail and responding to those technical consultations. It will help us inform the impact for this council. However, we aren't expected to know the actual confirmed values of that additional funding for Somerset until the provisional settlement is announced. Government say late autumn, actually turns into the beginning of December. So it's a watch this space, but we will be actively responding to those consultations. And beyond 2021, there does remain certainty, and therefore tight financial control must be sustained throughout this period and continue as it has done up to date. And I'm happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. A very welcome report. There's some issues in here. Clearly, there's lots of good news. And I think the danger is that we always focus on the issues, not the good news. But one I just want to mention, it seems to be Dillington. And we all know the history of Dillington, that it was taken on a nice 9-year lease. That it remains with us and has got 45 years to go. It's not what we call core market for a modern-day county council, but it is ours. And I wonder the loss of 290,000, and I suspect that this is just a journey. There may be a big loss, I don't know, coming. But what actions are we beginning to look at to try to resolve the Dillington issue? It's a small issue, but it's now standing out quite loudly. Who would like to respond on that? Oh, I'll let Pat as well.
The first thing to say is
there haven't been any movement since last month in these figures, and we did talk about it last month, but really just to reiterate everything you've said, Leader, it's not something that fits comfortably within what we do as a council. We're looking at plans and strategies as to how we can make that work best within the environment that we have. There's some positive stuff that is happening there in terms of the adult education movement of the skills teacher training services out there, which is reinvigorating the environment. But we're still facing some challenges around things like wedding revenue. We've had a number of posts that were vacant at some really key times. Those have now been filled. Some of the figures into next year are starting to look good, but it's about figuring out exactly what that plan needs to be and working that plan going forward, and we'll obviously keep Cabinet informed as to how that moves.
Thank you. Pat, we want to say something?
That's fine.
Okay. I mean, clearly this is a legacy asset. From wherever it came from, and clearly we can't give it back because that's not the deal, but we have to make it work, and it's fine in the way of making Dillington work because it becomes a distraction for us, I think. So full support to do what we can to support the staff, the management out there, to try to turn it around, and we just need to keep the focus. It's unfortunate that this is, as I say, not core business for us, but it is ours and we need to make it work. Right, any other questions? Okay, I'm going to go around the room. Liz Lation.
Thank you, Chair. Obviously, I welcome this report as much as everyone else.
Thank you. You can finish there, Liz.
And I just wanted to ask, perfectly simple question, are other upper-tier councils approaching Somerset for advice on the differences that have been made? I know what it's like to lead in the misery stakes, and I spent 2 years dealing with phone calls and emails asking me to sort out other people's problems. I just wondered whether that was coming this council's way, because if it's not, I'd probably be surprised.
Pat.
No. And interesting at the moment, if you do look around, there's a lot of authorities in, upper-tier authorities, city authorities, who appear to be getting themselves into a bit of trouble this year in terms of their overspend levels, or what will turn into a use of reserves, or what will be a lack of performance on delivering savings. So local government association know our performance. Local government association are very good, in fairness, as are the county council networks at linking people together. We've put our name out there to say if there's anything that we can do, we are more than happy to offer that. But at the moment, it seems quite closed up.
Faye, did you want to, was it a question or an answer?
No, it's to okay. Add to the answer. Just to say, we are actually, sorry, I've got to stand up, I've got a bad back. We are actually working with some other local authorities around the value of our school build. We've been recognised by Lord Agnew for the value of the school build programme and the fact that we're building schools efficiently. And we have been approached to help some other authorities to take some of those values learned forward. So there is a number of people reaching out on that side as to how we can help.
Mandy?
Can I just add to that very briefly? I think our peer challenge actually looked very closely at what we were doing and how we were doing it, and I know they work around the country, so I'm sure that information will follow around. And also, obviously, our recent auditors report, they have done a lot of work around how we've moved from last year to this year, and I'm absolutely sure that the auditors will share sort of good practice around. So whilst we're not seeing it directly, I think indirectly that it will be rippling around.
And without overdoing the answer, I think that there are aspects of what we've done over the last couple of years which have been picked up and nationally, particularly around social care, particularly the work around DTOC, and that's all been recognised, the work on school builds. I think overall, I think Pat was very accurate when he gave the answer of no. There doesn't seem to be that sort of learning culture between local authorities, which is quite sad, really. We're always happy to welcome people. We did have Kent the other day that came along to talk to us, but perhaps there needs to be more. Going around the room. Okay, so that leads us to the recommendations relating to this revenue budget, and doesn't it feel like it's a very different place to where we were last September? The recommendations are that the Cabinet approve the transfer of 0.175 million of corporate contingency to allocate the grant funding for Brexit. Sorry, mentioned it, an hour and a quarter. To a specific Brexit budget within economic community and infrastructure, as in section 4.7, and note the forecast balance budget position for the end of 1920 to note that 6.033 million of the corporate contingency remains unallocated if the above recommendation is approved, and this is expected to increase as management actions on service variances are confirmed, and to note the delivery of 16.99 million savings by month four and the forecast delivery of 21.485 million by the year end of the total target of 21.547. All those in favour of those recommendations, please show.
That's unanimous, Chair.
Unanimous. Thank you. And I know we were there critical of Dillington, but I think it probably shows how much all the other areas are under control, that Dillington suddenly becomes our issue. So I apologise for that, but I do think that is illustrated in the report. So we move to the final item, which is item 8, month 4 capital budget monitoring report. I think we've got Ben here to help us with this one in Sheila's absence, and I'll hand over again to Mandy to introduce, and then I presume it might be Ben that's going to add more, or Lizzie.
Questions.
Excellent, fine. Over to you, Mandy.
Thank you. So Ben's our technical backup, so welcome. So this is actually the first time the report for the capital budget has been presented to Cabinet in this financial year, and it shows that the Council's capital programme totals £788 million. I think it's worth pausing on that figure for a moment. It's a big figure. This is made up of several areas. 730 million of schemes agreed as part of previous budget setting processes that are still active. Also an additional £134 million that was added to the capital programme as a result of decisions taken at the February 2019 council meeting. There's also some £106 million of schemes that have been completed and removed from the programme, and you will also see that there are various other adjustments, mainly relating to grant funding that the Council receives in relation to local enterprise partnership schemes that the Council leads on behalf of partners. Of the total £788 million programme, approximately £400 million of the spend has been incurred in previous years. The remaining £380 million is to fund schemes both this year and into the next 4 years. The programme shows the continued successful delivery of considerable infrastructure across the county that supports an improved platform for delivery of public services across the area and provides beneficial outcomes for residents of Somerset. Members will note that the current programme is forecasting an underspend of £1.355 million, and this means that schemes are expected to be delivered at lower cost than originally expected, reflecting how well managed the capital programme is. The underspend is mainly due to a highways scheme that has been delivered for less than anticipated and an underspend in corporate ICT anticipated spend. Details of the specific forecasts can be seen in Appendix C. In the spirit of continual financial reporting improvement and greater visibility, future monitoring reports will also show developer contributions not yet received to reflect the large scale of the capital programme with an additional risk rating on these contributions. In conclusion, this first capital budget monitoring report for 1920 shows that the programme is being managed proactively by services within the resources that they have available. The capital programme reaffirms that Somerset is open for business. We're building new schools for our young people. We're working with partners to build new innovation centres, creating jobs and strengthening Somerset's economy. And we're building new roads to keep our county moving. I'm sure Cabinet members will be happy to answer any specific questions along with Ben and Lizzie.
Lizzie, over to you for any more technical
Just a couple of additional points, Chair, thank you. You will notice that in the appendices there's an awful lot of additional information and an awful lot of numbers, so we do apologise for that. We're happy to take anybody through.
Never apologise for detail. We like detail.
They are quite a lot. However, I just wanted to point out that the capital programme is made up of different funding sources, such as borrowing and grants and contributions and capital receipts and capital reserves. So the detail of that can be seen in the appendices. It is worth just noting that the forecasts are likely to alter as we progress during the year, especially where we are dependent on external elements and influences that are outside of the direct control of the authority. The next report will consider the impact on the total programme of any relevant changes from this report as well, so you can track the changes through the life of the programme. Thank you.
Thank you, and I think it has got much greater visibility, so appreciated. Ben, well done. Right, questions on the capital budget monitoring report for this for month four around the table. David Huxtable.
Chairman, I know I go towards the end, you know, page 87, when I see all these wonderful underspends, which I'm always very pleased to see, but one bullet point two on page 87, that's a 4.6 million favourable variance. I guess that's an underspend. But then it's offset against the following three school projects. So, I mean, an extra £1 million against Bridgewater Academy and an extra £3 million against the new Bridgepool Special School. How do we get it that wrong to start with?
Okay, who's going to take that? Is that, I presume that's you, Francis, or Julian?
Well,
let's keep it succinct.
Succinctly, the capital programme is developed, as we all know, on the basis of the papers that we have all approved about how we estimate future demand, how we understand costs of meeting that demand, where we understand development is to be. What we cannot do is use a crystal ball and know exactly which houses are coming forward and which houses are not coming forward. Some schools can be pushed back a year or two, some can be brought forward. Because of the way that the capital programme has worked around basic need for schools, we have underspent in this place and used it there because that one's come forward. And while absolutely there needs to be complete transparency about this, there would be a way not to be possible to work in this way. I think we would be asking for a much bigger allocation for contingencies.
Did you want to add anything to that?
Only these are quite complex schemes, and as part of the work we identify particular issues in terms of particular costs, etc. This is obviously a collaborative approach across the council with education services, procurement and property services involved in that process as well. So there's clear accountabilities in terms of how we manage that collectively. And obviously finance as well in terms of those arrangements.
And the last part of the answer from Paula.
Just to explain on those particular schools, some of the things that I've played in have been archaeology that was discovered once work begun. It's always difficult. You do some investigation, but so at least where you haven't done a trial trench that you find something, isn't it? And there have been some ground condition issues on another site where we've had to adapt what we were doing that were not, again, known up front. So I think, yes, we collectively working across education and property colleagues try to get these things right, but to be honest, there will always be some unexpected things that may be positive or negative that come to light when you start, and this is about managing those within the programme.
Thank you. Other questions, please? Ms. Lation.
Thank you, Chair. I have a page reference number, page 83. So just a quick question on financing from new debt, and just asking, is there a timeline on when that borrowing will be needed?
Lizzie?
That's almost the $50 million question for us, not $50 question. We obviously will take significant advice from our internal treasury management advisors as well as our external advisors. It's a really careful balance between that treasury activity, managing our cash flow and managing the needs of the funding across the authority. One thing that we will be clear about is, as these forecasts progress, how much need there may be, how much spend we are likely, and what slippage there is in the capital programme. So at this stage in the year, we would not be making a definitive decision about that. We will look further as these forecasts become firmer and it's known exactly what those funding streams are. We obviously will still focus on maximising as many external opportunities as possible for grants and developer contributions for a programme at this scale. So we try to minimise the impact of the borrowing. So it isn't a definitive, it will happen then. It is a mixture of all sorts of elements, quite tricky taking advice where we need to.
Thank you. Other questions? Oh, Anna Groscott, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question really is about developer contributions, and it said we're going to record those received that have not been received. If this becomes a problem, is it time that we ask that a bond be put in place before the monies are due? Because it now seems quite fashionable for developers to opt out of many contributions.
Paul, I think we're going to let answer that one.
So I think what Lizzie was referring to is quite often developer contributions are due when they reach a certain number of house starts or house completions. Therefore, we know that money's coming, but they haven't reached a point where they have to pay it to us yet, so it's recording those. You're right, there's also an issue sometimes about developers trying to renegotiate some of the agreements and look at viability things. We work really closely with our district councils and are increasingly working with them to address those issues. We've also got the changing landscape of community infrastructure levy, and again we're working with our district councils to make sure that works to ensure the infrastructure that's needed for those people moving into those houses is properly funded. Because this is about serving our communities absolutely well, making sure people have the infrastructure they need. So it's very much quite a complex and changing field, but yet we're monitoring it all the time and we'll use bonds where we feel that's necessary.
Thank you. Other questions? No. That brings us to the end of that item as well. It's good to see so much work going in and such a level of monitoring. So, and I recognise that there's a need in places to move those capital funds around to meet the immediate demand, particularly in school builds. But the report is before us, and the recommendation is that we note the contents of the report. All those happy with that recommendation, please show. Thank you. Unanimous. Thank you. I have no other notice of any other business. Therefore, the meeting is concluded at 11:28. Thank you all for your time.